Welcome to Not Your Boyfriend's Sports Show. I'm Bryn.
And I'm Maeve. And this week on the show, Serena is sick, both literally and figuratively. The NHL and NBA playoffs are in full swing. Softball is more popular than ever. And the Women's World Cup is finally here! Our feature this week concludes our two-part series on sports and domestic abuse. We discuss what leagues have done to win back women, whether they go far enough, and if they are sincere. Then we introduce our newest segment, Orphan Stories. Bryn, what's going on this week in sports?
So this week, Serena Williams won the French Open, which is impressive for a myriad of reasons.
Ooh, good vocab.
Thanks. First of all, the girl had the flu. Yeah. Maeve, I'm not sure what you're capable of when you have the flu, but the most I can do is make sure my Netflix marathons don't time out. So, yeah, that was impressive in its own right. Secondly, this marks Serena's 20th career Grand Slam singles title, which puts her only two wins behind the all-time leader Steffi Graf. And to top it all off, Serena gave her post-match speech in French because she's fluent in French because, of course, she is.
Of course.
So, basically, I'm bowing down to Serena Williams this week.
Oh, my gosh. That's ridiculous. Well, switching gears to softball, great series for softball.
The Very exciting.
Women's College World Series was last week. The Florida Gators bested Michigan. Sorry, Bryn.
Tear.
In the three-game series, they won game three, 4-1, and this was their second consecutive national title. They were led by really strong pitching from Lauren Hager, who was also named National Player of the Year.
She was seriously impressive.
Seriously impressive. But what was also impressive is that this year set attendance and television records for softball. So total attendance over the whole course of the series was 78,000.
Wow.
And this included the fourth highest championship game attendance at 7,680. But perhaps the bigger story is that the television numbers were the most watched tournament in history, with an average of 2 million viewers. And the championship game was the second most watched ever, with 2,273,000 viewers.
That's awesome.
Yeah, those are great numbers.
We were watching the entire series, and it was keeping us wrapped. So I can see why the numbers are high.
Yeah.
In other series news, the Women's World Cup has officially kicked off.
Woo!
Yeah. Now that each team in the World Cup has played its first match of the tournament, we've gotten a glimpse into who the contenders are. And who might not be putting up much of a fight.
Right.
So it looks like Nigeria is shaping up to be a surprise contender as they took Sweden to a 3-3 tie in their first game. And Sweden's next game is against the U.S., so we'll see how they respond from that disappointing result. In other interesting scores, Germany beat the Ivory Coast 10-0.
Poor Ivory Coast.
So sad.
So sad.
The game had two hat tricks.
It's
crazy. Like, the first one.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And it was the second most lopsided win in Women's World Cup history. The first was Germany over Argentina 11-0. So, kind of a sad one there. But hopefully the Ivory Coast can put up a fight against someone else in their group.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that there's still such a blowout because this year, a lot of the commentary surrounding the tournament has been about how the second-tier teams are so much better than they've ever been before. And
yeah.
So there are sort of no guaranteed wins.
Most of the games were within one goal. It was a lot of really tight scores, but that was not one of them. For the U.S. women's national team first game, they faced off against Australia and looked a little shaky.
Yeah.
But they ended up coming away with a 3-1 win over the Aussies, with Megan Rapinoe scoring two goals and Kristen Press scoring the third.
Megan Rapinoe, she's one of my favorite people.
Hero.
I just love her so much. And Abby Wambach is totally trying to steal her haircut right now.
Yeah, not pulling it off so well.
Not as well.
But the second set of group stage games are set to begin on Thursday, the day that this podcast will come out. And the U.S.'s next game is against Sweden on Friday. So find your local sports bar and cheer on our girls.
8 p.m., I believe?
8 p.m.
On yep. Fox.
Great.
Straight up Fox. Not even Fox Sports 1.
Look at that.
Regular old Fox.
Women are rising through the ranks.
All right. Well, speaking of ranks, Cleveland and the Golden State Warriors are both trying to earn that number one rank in basketball.
Yeah, they are.
Cleveland has taken the series lead. They're now up 2-1. This is despite injuries to two of the Cavaliers' stars, Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love, which really led a lot of people to say that the Warriors would win this pretty easily, especially after Kyrie Irving went out in game one.
Yeah.
But Cleveland is showing a lot of resilience. LeBron proving again why he really is the best there is. He had another, he almost had another triple-double, which a triple-double is when you have double digits in three stats categories. So he scored 40 points, had 12 rebounds, and 8 assists. So he almost got a second triple-double there. But another fun little storyline to watch has been Della Vadova, who is this Australian player for the Cavaliers who's really come out of nowhere given these injuries.
And he's like a small guy. Like, he doesn't look that impressive when you just look at him.
So he scored 20 points in the most recent game. But he was, however, taken to the hospital after that game for severe cramping. He's out of the hospital now, but we'll see how his game goes.
I feel like that's
forward.
Not even that surprising, though, because if you watch him play, like, the amount of times he will fling his body across the court, like, he just plays so hard and so scrappy that, like, I'm not surprised that he was severely dehydrated or
cramping.
Sure,
but, like, wouldn't you? This is maybe your one chance to...
I know, but he's, like, the number one guy for just, like, throwing his body against everything else.
I say risk it all now, because when those star players are back, he's not going to be on the court anymore. But one funny thing from a friend of the show who I was discussing this NBA series with earlier, and she was trying to decide who to root for because she had no hometown preference. And she decided to root for LeBron and the Cavaliers simply because, and I quote, "Steph Curry chews on his mouth guard," which I find uncouth.
That's amazing.
So when you have two great teams, I guess it really boils down to the details.
Man, especially against a player that's the most well-liked person in the entire league.
I know. Well, I know that you really loved his daughter.
Oh, yeah. Riley Curry's the real MVP of the tournament.
For quoting Drake, I think.
Yes. So Steph Curry's 2-year-old daughter, yeah. Riley Curry, has accompanied him to some of the press conferences, and she took the mic, quoted Drake lyrics, and then Steph took it back and kept talking.
She's
incredible.
But anyway, NBA is not the only playoffs happening right now.
No, this seems to be like the week or month of playoffs. It's crazy. So we don't want to skip over the NHL Stanley Cup Finals, which are well underway. The Chicago Blackhawks and Tampa Bay Lightning are currently playing, and the series is 2-1 for Tampa Bay, but Game 4 is being played as
right.
we record
when
this.
When we say currently playing, like, we mean that very literally.
We could check the score right now.
It was 0-0 right before we started recording.
Okay, so we still don't know. But Game 4 should be pretty interesting because the Tampa Bay Lightning starting goaltender Ben Bishop is not playing. So the Blackhawks may have a chance to tie up the series tonight. And it's been like a weird little storyline because Bishop has had this undisclosed injury throughout this entire series. And he left the ice twice in game 2, which led people to seriously question whether or not he just really had to poop. And then they put him in front of like the press conference later and he like wouldn't say anything about the injury. And so people are just like, what is wrong with this guy?
I mean, nervous pooping is a thing.
Now it's looking like the injury probably isn't Bell related,
but that's too bad.
Unclear still. No one said anything about what it actually is.
Oh, don't you just love the internet sometimes?
I really do. A poop story is always a good one.
Maybe that's what we should call the episode, a poop story. Anyway, on that note, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be wrapping up our discussion on sports and domestic abuse.
Great.
I'm here for a good time, not a long time, you know, I haven't had a good time in a long time, you know, I'm way up, I feel blessed, way up, I feel blessed,
straight up,
I'm way up, I feel blessed,
straight up,
way up.
Welcome back. So, today is part two of our series on sports and domestic abuse. And given what a terrible year it was for sports and women, namely the NFL, a number of sports organizations have since tried to, quote, win back women through various public safety campaigns and reports on their internal efforts. So today we're going to talk about, is this actually effective? Is this actually sincere? Do their actions behind the scenes match the tone with which they're taking in public? Or are they really just recognizing that women represent an important economic opportunity, they're a growing population of fans, and are they just doing the minimum of what they need to keep up appearances without seriously changing the structure and standards of their organizations and hurting their bottom line?
It seems like there's a real spectrum here.
Yes, which we'll get to. But first, let's talk about just how many female sports fans there are. What population are we really talking about? So, across all the major sports, so this is the NFL, the NBA, MLB, NHL, plus golf, NASCAR, college sports, there's actually a surprisingly steady proportion of women who watch, and that's about a third of the audience for these sports is women. So if you look at just big games or championships and take a pretty conservative estimate, because viewership during finals is typically higher, we're talking about 2 million viewers during the Stanley Cup, 5.2 million female viewers during the NBA Finals, 4.5 during the World Series, and 37 and change during the Super Bowl, although better estimates put female viewership of the Super Bowl at 45%, so that's about 50 million viewers. And these are actually relatively high numbers considering that the most popular television shows among women typically garner around 1 to 2 million viewers per episode. Plus, women control purchasing power. We've talked about this a little bit before, but according to the Boston Consulting Group, women control or influence 73% of all household purchases. And as audiences become more fragmented because they have more options of what to watch, women's purchasing power is only getting stronger. Some analysts that I was reading about were saying that yeah, there's a good audience of women for sports, but there are more targeted ways to reach women. But all I'm saying is that more women watch Sunday Night Football than The Bachelorette. So great. I'm proud of women right now.
Yeah.
Even as a fan of The Bachelor franchise.
You can watch both. It's okay. Okay, so let's start our examination of the different leagues and their responses to this on a net positive note. I would say that the NBA is a pretty good example of an organization taking a decisive and proactive response to the recent domestic violence issues around all sports. So the NBA, WNBA, and leanin.org partnered to support gender equality at home and at work through a social media campaign, ads featuring some of the biggest names in the NBA, like LeBron James, Chris Bosh, and Dwayne Wade. And it also included Sheryl Sandberg, who is a big name in feminism right now in general. So roping her into an NBA media campaign is probably like a good idea to engage a certain subset of women.
Yeah, putting aside some of the criticisms of Sheryl Sandberg's philosophy.
Right. That one has both positives and negatives,
but
I guess.
Not the point of this particular episode.
Yeah. So in my opinion, this is smart on behalf of the NBA to get in front of all the other bad press in the other leagues and the other teams, especially considering that the WNBA is one of the only commercially successful women's sports, although that's, you know, a small portion.
Barely commercially successful.
Yeah. But NBA Commissioner Adam Silver has consistently shown that he's in touch with social issues. He's made really decisive moves at the right time, like fining and banning Donald Sterling after racist comments, supporting Jason Collins and LGBT issues in the NBA, and his response to a domestic violence case with an NBA player last year. Where Adam Silver suspended him for 24 games without pay after an independent investigation. And that's more than the minimum required suspension for a domestic violence felony. So he really, upped the ante. And there was a lot of pushback from the Players Association, from a lot of different parties. And he's just shown, zero desire to back down on that. He stood firm and recommended that the player, Jeff Taylor, recommended that he use his 80 hours of community service to help victims of domestic violence. So Adam Silver is just like really out in front of this issue and not worried about any pushback from the other side.
And I'd also say that this current NBA season, it's a long season, that NBA season.
It really is.
You know, there's been a lot of social unrest surrounding Ferguson and some of the other police brutality instances. And NBA players have been pretty vocal, wearing kind of I can't breathe t-shirts or wearing hoodies during games.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, there have been no repercussions for any, you know, breaking uniform dress code or things like that, which is completely different than what we've seen in the NFL.
Totally.
Where they get dinged for, you know, wearing green cleats during Pink Awareness Month.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that's all coming from Commissioner Adam Silver, and it's an example that's in such stark contrast to the NFL, where Roger Goodell is 100% reactionary and often not in a strong enough way. So Adam Silver has shown time and time again that he really just has like his finger on the pulse of his league and of the public at large. So
yeah.
So the campaign with leanin.org is really, at this point, it seems to be a social media hashtag, a commercial, and then there's an NBA page on leanin.org.
Right.
So it's not a huge sweeping campaign. It's relatively small in its efforts, but it was a pretty early and
got out of the gate.
It was a thoughtful campaign that highlighted the issues like right up front. And I would assume, given everything else that the NBA has done, that this is just the start of the conversation for them.
Yeah, especially because this Lean In Together campaign wasn't geared toward one issue, like domestic violence. It's really more about gender equality at home, at work, the broader ways in which having women be equally successful is actually makes men more successful, makes companies more successful, makes families more successful. So it kind of took a broader path, which I guess gives them more flexibility, lets fans relate to it in more personalized ways.
Yeah, it's a pretty inclusive campaign.
Yeah, definitely. Which is very different from what the NFL has been trying to do. Like you said, they've been very reactive. They've kind of had to be, because the Ray Rice incident is really what blew this whole conversation up into a really national conversation. So unlike the NBA, the NFL was really playing from behind. And while they have mounted a pretty impressive publicity campaign, there's still so much more skepticism surrounding their efforts. But just to give a quick review, perhaps the best known instance is a commercial played during the Super Bowl called the 911 call. I don't know if it's actually called that. But anyway, it features a 911, a real 911 call, where the woman on the phone keeps trying to order a pizza until the operator realizes that she's in danger in her own home and she needs help. And it's paired with this visual of a house that has furniture knocked over and evidence of a conflict. So this was a commercial that was made in partnership with No More, which is an anti-domestic violence coalition. So this was basically donated airtime from the NFL, and it had followed other ads throughout the season from No More, featuring NFL players saying no more to common excuses like, but he had such a bright future, or she never said no, and all the kind of common tropes that you hear around sexual assault. And there was another featuring celebrities that mostly silently and tearfully were looking at the camera with the tagline something like, domestic violence is hard to talk about, help us start the conversation. So I think that the 911 call commercial was pretty effective. It really pulled at the heartstrings. The No More commercials I appreciated because they addressed some of the common excuses and brought light to those, and how we all kind of, even if we don't, you know, use them and get behind them, at least maybe think of them before we have to walk ourselves back. The sort of it's hard to talk about commercials maybe seem a little more insincere when Hillary Swank is like tearing up in front of the camera.
Yeah, I didn't feel like those got the point across so much. It was just like, it was uncomfortable. I mean, that was that was conveyed, but they weren't the strongest.
And maybe, I mean, just the fact that people watch them because they're celebrities.
Right.
Anyway, but the creators of the ads say that these were actually really aimed at bystanders or people who know somebody who are in an abusive relationship to try to maybe identify what it looks like, what they could do, how domestic abuse can be really isolating, and to encourage them to reach out. But another interesting sort of conversation that was happening around the discussion of these commercials is that the NFL's issues with women don't occur in a vacuum. And so, you know, one commercial campaign is great, but does this fully address the spectrum of issues that the NFL has? So, as I said at the beginning, still skepticism around the campaign, although the commercials were effective, they were widespread, they got talked about a lot.
Well, and I think that while there have been a lot of efforts by the NFL to make changes in their code of conduct, to put out these ads, to do all kinds of things, it didn't feel like Roger Goodell was coming through really strongly on this issue. He like wavered with Ray Rice's suspension. He just, at every step, he sort of took a half step and was like, is this enough? Like, he wasn't trying to be really decisive and really get out there. He was
No, you're right. That's exactly how it felt.
But one interesting thing that we came across in talking about the Ray Rice case and the Super Bowl commercial is that since the Ray Rice video was posted to TMZ, calls to the National Domestic Violence Hotline spiked, and the number has stayed relatively high since then. So as much as it was a really hard video to watch and it spawned all of these commercials that we don't really, some of them we like, some of them we don't think are that effective, I think it's pretty clear that just getting the videos out there, getting the conversation into the public sphere has had a lot of impact on its own. And it's pretty encouraging to see that
It's one thing for us to sit around and discuss and debate how good certain commercials were, but that for a pretty large population of people, that the publicity of all of this, starting with Ray Rice's video being exposed, has maybe led to them getting help, maybe led to some changes in their life. I just thought it was pretty impressive that, you know, a spike after the video, sure. But for it to stay so high, I think maybe indicates that maybe things are shifting a little bit, that we are maintaining this conversation, and that there maybe is some evidence that it's not just all for publicity, that maybe there's some.
And we can pick apart the commercials as much as we want, but if it's actually helping people feel more comfortable getting help, then that's all we can really ask for.
Right. But otherwise, the NFL, there have been a lot of people watching kind of what else they're doing besides publicity to try to make amends for this, to try to make themselves better. So I guess the biggest talking point is that Goodell instituted a new policy of paid leave if a player is under investigation for a player conduct violation. So basically the new policy allows the NFL to investigate an arrest before the legal case plays out and put the player on paid leave. This was done, though, without the Players Association involved in the decision-making, which they have publicly been pretty upset about, that Goodell acted really unilaterally, and it's just another example that he only cares about the owners, he only cares about the team, he doesn't really care about individual players. They've also hired a consultant in New York prosecutor Lisa Friel, and she had specialized in sex crimes and is now working with the NFL on, you know, what they can be doing internally better.
Yeah, I think she's actually one of four top-ranking female officials that the NFL brought in with the charge that they need to advise on domestic violence issues. And they're building the training curriculum for the players. Their job is to disseminate more resources for families, for the players, the coaches, the officials, everyone involved in the NFL. So one of the other females that was brought in for that purpose is the NFL's Vice President of Social Responsibility, Anna Isaacson. And she has been the one leading all of the trainings on domestic violence, on sexual assault, consent, healthy relationships, like really going back to basics here. And they're trying to get in as soon as possible. They're holding these trainings before the draft for all the prospects coming in. And then repeatedly throughout the player's tenure, just reiterating more resources around how to handle yourself as a positive, in a positive relationship. And so they're really beefing up that those kinds of trainings, which I think is great, but at the same time, I would love for players to get in on that a lot earlier. Like, there's an article about the current draft class, and one of the players was quoted as saying, like, this is the first time anyone defined domestic violence to him. Mm-hmm. And, like, he'd never had this kind of conversation about consent and healthy relationships. So the fact that players are getting all the way through college and coming into the NFL with that lack of information is alarming. But the NFL is getting there as early as possible now, so I guess that's positive.
Yeah, I guess as much as I think the NFL should be doing, there is a part of this that we've talked about before. Sports don't exist in a vacuum. These players don't arrive at the NFL like shiny and clean and new.
Yeah.
So,
And one thing that you and I may have talked about throughout this entire thing is what should a player's punishment for domestic violence be? And I've really struggled with that because on the one hand, I obviously find domestic violence to be awful and in one sense unforgivable. But on the other hand, I don't necessarily think that a player should be banned forever from playing in a professional league because of one infraction, as long as they serve the punishments handed down to them. So there's an article from ESPNW that really helped me like distill my thoughts on this. And Lee Goodmark, who's a University of Maryland professor, made the argument that I find to be most compassionate to both sides and most objectively reasonable in terms of punishments. She basically said that second chances are important to give for a few reasons. The first one is that if a player is actually showing a real willingness to change and engagement with the process of changing, then depriving him, his wife, and his kids of his livelihood for the rest of what would be his career is a really, really severe penalty without giving him any opportunity for redemption. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like you hate the sin, but you should at least have some hope for the sinner. Is that her quote? So the second reason she gives is that zero tolerance and permanent bans of the player are a bad idea following a domestic violence incident because it acts as a total disincentive for the player's wife or girlfriend who's been abused to come forward. So especially in a case where the wife or girlfriend is committed to maintaining the relationship and hoping that her abuser will change, it cuts off a lot of avenues for the victims to deal with their issues, get help for themselves and their abusive partners if they feel like they're going to be taking away their partner's income for the rest of their lives. So in response to this, the professor from University of Maryland said that more than anything, male peer-to-peer intervention has been shown to be the most effective in reversing abusive behavior. So if there was a team that took ownership and whose mission it was to ensure that they weren't going to have these kinds of problems on their team, it might be a totally different thing. Where she outlines a scenario where a leader on the team goes to his team and says, we're going to hold everyone accountable for domestic violence, for having healthy relationships. If players were more open to talking to one another and saying, like, we're here for you if you need to talk, if you need to walk away, if you need a timeout, like, we'll put you up while you sort through all of this with your wife, while you go through your batterer's intervention counseling, and we'll be here for her too if there's a problem.
Yeah.
And if there's a problem and she calls us, you're going to have a bigger problem than just dealing with the authorities. So I think if the team is able to take this ownership and put the onus on themselves to police themselves, like, that would be a huge
thing. Kind of the Jason Witten situation.
Exactly. So Cowboys tight end Jason Witten is now on the team with Greg Hardy, who I believe we've discussed before. He missed 15 games last year and on a domestic violence charge. And Jason Witten was quoted as saying, "I think more than anything, I think everyone knows I'm against domestic violence. That's unwavering. That's something I've lived, my family lived, but that guy's a teammate of mine, and I think you have to look at it from that standpoint. As their coach says, it's our job to invite those guys in and create a standard of how we do things. I think he's done a great job since he's been here, but it's not my decision to decide who comes in."
I agree that there should be redemption. I definitely do. I guess that the disconnect for me is that playing sports for millions of dollars is not your average job, and there are a lot of people behind you who want their shot while you're getting a second shot. And I'm not saying that these players should be banished from society. I think it's quite the opposite, like you've discussed. They need to be incorporated. There needs to be networks of support. But there's still something to me that leaves a bad taste when people who commit crimes that should land them in jail and otherwise would get to keep throwing and catching balls for a living for a ridiculous sum of money. And so to me, if you're going to remain in the public sphere, you should have to serve the public. And so I want part of their redemption or of their deal to remain as a player is to have to dedicate a certain amount of time to community service, to awareness programs, to youth outreach. It shouldn't be enough to just say, "I'm sorry, I'm a changed man, I'm going to do better in the future." They should have to become an advocate. They should have to be publicly working toward preventing the mistakes that they made.
Yeah, and I also think that the more a player's rehabilitation or counseling or education, that process should be more out in the open.
Yeah.
Like, the more a player speaks out about, sort of in the way Adrian Peterson recently did, where he said, "I'm going through all this counseling for my actions, and this is what I've learned, and I feel like I'm making strides." Like, the more people come through with that kind of acknowledgement of what they've done and how they're learning from it, the less stigma there will be around getting help and becoming a better person.
Yeah. I think another thing we've talked about before, which I think applies here too, is sort of the flip side of this, right? The NFL and the players and the teams, they need to be making changes, but we also need to become critical consumers. And so kind of going back to the discussion about Super Bowl commercials, the domestic abuse, the 911 call commercial was not the only commercial that kind of played to women this Super Bowl. Some people dubbed it the first feminist Super Bowl. So if you'll remember, there was an Always commercial for pads that asked girls to run like a girl, throw like a girl.
Right.
There were some Dove and Nissan ads that featured kind of sappy moments with dads. And then there was a Nationwide commercial where Mindy Kaling, Mindy Kaling, felt invisible because she was a woman and a minority.
Yeah.
And so Ann Friedman wrote an article discussing all of these that I found kind of hit the nail on the head for me. She basically wrote about how there's this new trend in advertising called empowertizing. And it's basically like the equivalent of junk food. So it's high in calories, it's low in nutrition, it's these soaring messages with few concrete policies or actions behind them. People watch the commercials, they feel good about them, then they don't have to think about the companies behind them and if their practices actually match their presentation. So like, do Dove and Nissan have paternity leave? Does Always work with, you know, girls' empowerment programs? We mentioned earlier the No More Coalition, and Ann Friedman points out that this is basically a PR group that's funded by a collection of large companies. It has no full-time staff of its own, and its website links you to other organizations that are doing really good work, but the point being that, you know, you eat it up as one thing, and really it's just funneling you to organizations that already exist. So basically, she argues that this sort of empowertizing allows the NFL to promote its image, work with brands, but still do very little on the front line of domestic abuse. And she had a quote that I just so related to, and she said, "You wanted the attention of viewers like me, you got it. But now that you have it, don't be surprised to hear that I have a few follow-up questions."
Yeah.
And so to me, it's like, if we are going to be maybe cynically realistic about this. There's the power of the purse, and if that's what, if money is really what this all gets driven by, and if we as female fans are demanding attention because we're this growing population, we want to be catered to, then, you know, how far do we really demand our dollar to go? Because at this point, I want my dollar to go a little further.
Amen.
All right. Well, I think that about wraps this section up. And when we come back, we're going to give a home to some orphan articles.
Okay, so welcome back. This week, instead of highlighting a fierce lady, we thought we could highlight an article that's been sitting in our Evernote of interesting reads, which we're going to call Orphan Stories, because they didn't have an episode home.
Right.
So this week, it's an interview with the ladies who created SoulCycle, and we'll link to the article in the podcast description. It's a story about female entrepreneurship, building a brand, a commitment to exclusivity and luxury. Mm. And Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice are the duo behind it, who describe themselves more as fitness users rather than fitness teachers. And to me, I think that's a huge reason why they've been so successful. They knew their market from the beginning because they were their market, and they knew what people wanted and how to pitch it to them, basically.
Yeah, so what I found really interesting about this article that we read was that they, nowadays, this sort of boutique fitness class, pay by class kind of model seems really in vogue, and it's kind of hard to remember when this wasn't a thing, but they started SoulCycle in 2006. So that's almost a decade ago.
That seems like a long time ago to me.
So there wasn't a pay per class model. This idea of like, classes as brands, classes as like a identity badge weren't really a thing yet.
Even I feel like Lululemon wasn't even as cult popular as it is now.
Yeah. So, well, have you ever been to a SoulCycle class?
I haven't.
I haven't either. Shall we? Maybe. I'd be interested to hear why you haven't been to one.
I haven't been to one. Probably because it's cost prohibitive for me.
How much is it?
It's $34 a class.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah. That's... And there's no, you can't sign up for like a class pass. So like a lot of yoga studios, you can take 10 classes. And so if you sign up for a 10 class pass, it'll be cheaper.
Right.
SoulCycle, it's just $34 per class.
Yeah.
No discounts. And I've taken spin classes at various points in my life, and like some of them are more intense than others. Some of them are more mountain bikey.
Yeah.
So I have a good idea of what SoulCycle would be. Yeah. I just haven't ever felt the urge to shell out for it.
Yeah, I think cost is one thing. I think that a little bit of its reputation is another thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally down with females running their own businesses, and especially surrounding health and fitness, like get at it. That's great. But I thought that the article was interesting because they seem to be really good at spin and not the exercise, but
the PR spin side.
Because they were asked like, you know, are you ever going to offer classes for a lower price? And they were like, no, people value what they pay for.
Yeah.
And then they asked them about front row divas, who are people who take it really seriously and always sit in the front row.
Which is an actual phenomenon.
Yes. Let's get to that in a second because I want to talk about it more. But they were asked about these front row divas, and their answer was like, yeah, you know, people are proud of what they've accomplished and they want to lead their community and share their energy. And I was just like, okay. And then you read, this article linked to the Front Row Divas article. Yeah. And you read that and it just seems like these women and men who are just so intense and competitive about it that I think it would just take a lot of the fun out of it.
I think the owners have a very thin veil of this is for everyone.
Right.
Like we're very welcoming, but if you step into a class, like even walking by the SoulCycle in DC and seeing people come out of there, they're all like sizing each other up and like comparing their spandex like looks. And yeah. They're all just very intense.
And that this article was laying out how instructors control who's in the front row or not. And they either invite you up or they tell you to move back. Or they have other staff members come in and fill empty seats if they don't think that anybody is up to par.
Oh, God.
And so there were these two differing opinions from riders about making it to the front row. And this one woman was really proud of herself, and she said, "I kept looking at myself in the mirror during class thinking, I feel strong and beautiful." So I can get on board with that.
Yeah.
If that's what she's getting out of it. But then, like, next paragraph, this other rider who had picked the front row bike because it was the only one available and had a bad experience with it said, "It's the 1 hour of the day when I can decompress, so I don't want to be stressed about following or worrying about people silently hating me."
Yeah, like, I think I'm more with her on that. Yeah. I don't think I would want to be in the front row if people are going to be constantly judging me.
Totally. I feel like I'm a competitive person, but if there's not an actual competition going on with scorekeeping, etc., then I'm not so sure I want to make that a very important part of my life.
I'm with you.
Yeah, and as much as we've sort of been like, oh, why don't they offer lower prices, whatever, you know, you gotta give them props for sticking to their guns, and they found this business model, and it, you know, is...
And they're making bank off of it.
Totally, and if they can, you know, take exclusivity to the bank and luxury to the bank, then, you know, good on you.
Yep.
I don't want to pay $34, but...
I'll go to the YMCA.
Okay, well, I think that that about does it for this episode. So, Bryn, where should they find us online?
You can find us on Facebook at Now Your Boyfriend Sports Show, on Instagram and Twitter at NYBF Sports, and we are on iTunes and Stitcher. I think we may be abandoning SoundCloud.
It could be. Sorry, SoundCloud listeners.
So let us know if that's important to you and we can figure out how to keep it going. But for now, iTunes and Stitcher are where you can find us. And
you can email us.
You can email us.
nybfsports@gmail.com.
That would be lovely.
All right. Good game, Bryn.
Good game, Maeve.